Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today we're going to be talking about the Planet of the Apes franchise, but there are 8 movies in the franchise to discuss, so we had to break this one into 2 parts. In this episode, we're going to talk about Planet of the Apes from 1968, Beneath the Planet of the Apes from 1970, Escape from the Planet of the Apes from 1971, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes from 1972. In part 2, we're going to talk about Battle for the Planet of the Apes from 1973, briefly touch on the 1974 series, Tim Burton's 2001 film Planet of the Apes, and then skip right on over to Rise of the Planet of the Apes from 2011, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes from 2014, and War for the Planet of the Apes from 2017. So without further ado, did you have anything you wanted to say about the original franchise, Steve?
Sure. I'll be honest, for the longest time, I wasn't sure why they kept trying to drag Planet of the Apes out into a franchise. The original movie is a sci-fi classic, we'll go into a little bit. But for the longest time, I felt like there wasn't much more that needed to be said about it. But then I realized the setting itself was really interesting, and that you get some really good post-apocalyptic science fiction just by using those elements. But why don't we talk about the basic ideas of the series?
Oh, sure, Steve. But if I may comment on what you said first there, I think the biggest draw for me with the sequels was finding out how it all happened. I mean, we see the Planet of the Apes in the original films, but like Taylor himself asked, you know, how did it all happen? But as you say, we'll get into that in a minute. You know, there are a few themes that come up again and again in those first 5 movies. The first is an exploration of how animals are treated, though sometimes the human is the animal in that scenario. They show the humans being rounded up, beaten, hosed, experimented on, and killed for the purposes of the apes without any concern for them. This, especially back in the world of 1978, reflected the treatment of animals of various sorts in the modern world. But you see the harsh mistreatment of the apes in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. And you see number 2 on my list of the themes in the original franchise, and that is slavery. We see the apes being enslaved, conditioned and trained, as well as marketed, just how the Americans once treated their slaves. Now, slavery was obviously over by 1968, but struggles caused by it when that did happen in America were still fresh on everyone's mind as the civil rights movement was going on. These two concepts kind of blend in the franchise, where we see both the slavery and animal cruelty themes blending together when they're about apes being used as slaves. But there is also nuclear war. Basically, man destroys each other. Cornelius gives a big old speech about how one of the biggest contributors to man's downfall is that we kill each other. And he contrasts that with the apes, who don't kill one another. That's, of course, not true, and I'm guessing Cornelius probably heard as much about the times of his father, and even talked about getting his head lopped off if he used Taylor to prove his theory. So clearly, Ape does kill Ape, but that's not my point. The theme of violence and war being a bad thing was definitely going on in the films, as well as in real life at the time during the original franchise. The war in Vietnam was going on, and the whole time, as were the protests against it, clear up into 1975 when it ended. post-apocalyptic futures of nuclear wastelands were how the world was viewing things, especially during the Cold War, which was going on at that time too. Another thing that we see in the films is religious fanaticism, another big fear of its day, but we see that in both apes and in humans in the series. I'm particularly reminded of Dr. Zaius' refusal to even look at anything outside of what is written in the scrolls by the lawgiver. That is exactly like Christian behavior, particularly back in 1968, how they felt about things. I mean, if anything contradicted their perspective of what the Bible says or doesn't say, it was vehemently rejected and even called evil.
Very true. Planet of the Apes is very much about putting the shoe on the other foot and putting humans in the place of animals to make a point. This is especially true when they deal with issues like animal exploitation, hunting, and scientific experimentation on animals. It asks the question of whether we would like it if those things were done to us, and if not, what should be done to solve the problem?
That is very true. But what the movies do not necessarily answer is what the solution would be for the problem. Both humans and apes talk about how much they have learned and gained by such practices. At the same time, the whole practice is based on it being okay as long as they aren't doing it to their own species, which begs the question, is it wrong or not? If it's wrong, then it should be wrong no matter who's doing it.
Yeah, it's a series that deals heavily with situational ethics. You're also right that war and slavery are two issues that get tackled, although some movies handle those issues more delicately than others. The Burton reboot, for instance, makes very modern parallels to modern-day race issues, but some of the other films handle it on a more allegorical level, particularly some of the earlier films. While I think the idea was more to reflect the idea of animal capture, it can definitely be interpreted as a commentary on slavery, which the apes' treatments of humans certainly is in practice. There's also a definite line of reason versus violence with Zira and Cornelius as the peaceful counterpoint to war and brutality. This especially becomes an issue in the second film, where Zira and Cornelius are able to cooperate with Dr. Zaius early on because the gorilla's imperialist ambitions represent a threat to their society. They may disagree on many different things, but ultimately they agree that science is better than war.
There are certainly parallels there to slavery, but I would say that the possession of slaves and the cruel treatment of them is something both sides did. Both sides viewed the other as inferior and even demonized the other, that they felt to be lesser, to excuse their actions. But as far as the gorillas go, I honestly never felt like the gorillas were portrayed all that well. I mean, an entire race of apes that are not smart and don't want to be. We see them refusing to learn in class and even trashing a school. A race that thinks it in very simple, basic thoughts, if Battle for the Planet of the Apes is any sign anyway. I mean, you notice most of Aldo's sentences were like two or three words and only said one at a time. and the only thing that seems to concern gorillas is war, fighting and power. There are individuals like that for certain, but to make a whole race that way, it just always felt a bit off to me. I would have preferred that the apes in general were not pigeonholed into personality types based solely on their race. It doesn't leave room for individuality, nor does it account for the other two races of apes preferring, as you say, reason over war. But we'll get more into that later.
Yeah, the gorillas do often tend to be portrayed as one-note brutes, and that really is a shame. As for Dr. Zaius, I think you covered his ideology fairly well. Though I'd add that Zaius also represents a dogmatic form of science where nothing is allowed to be questioned or reevaluated. Although Zaius is blind by his own zealotry, it represents a science that can only be seen from a single perspective. And that's not really proper science. I mean, science has to have room for previous conclusions to be tested, retested, and reevaluated when evidence shows that the previous findings don't hold up under scrutiny. Though faith and science don't have to be mutually exclusive, the problem with Zaius is that for him, science has to validate faith. That doesn't allow room for that faith to be properly questioned, even when the science doesn't support that view. And when the entire ape society is designed to uphold that belief system, not much of value is going to change for the positive.
I can agree with that. But I think Dr. Zaius goes beyond being blinded by his faith. When confronted with empirical evidence that what he believes is wrong, he not only rejects it, he destroys any proof that it ever existed. That seems to speak of knowing his beliefs are false, but sticking to them anyway.
Point. I think Zaius is about maintaining ape society, whatever the cost is. He's for whatever keeps the status quo intact and keeps the apes in a dominant position over humans. If that means rejecting science, he's willing to do that.
Then we are on the same page with Dr. Zaius. But speaking of which, I think it's about time we dove into the classic film that started it all. Planet of the Apes came out in 1968, directed by Franklin J. Schaffner, and was loosely based on the 1963 French novel La Planète des Singes by Pierre Boulle. Technically, directly translated, La Planète des Singes means the planet of the monkeys. But you have to admit that Apes has a nice ring to it. Anyway, the screenplay was written by Michael Wilson and Rod Serling. It stars Charles Heston as Taylor, Roddy McDowall as Dr. Cornelius, Kim Hunter as Dr. Zira, Maurice Evans as Dr. Zaius, and Linda Harris as Nova. The outline of the Planet of the Apes script, originally written by Rod Serling, underwent many rewrites before filming eventually began. Serling had originally written a much more advanced society for the apes in keeping with the original novel, and his script would have cost a lot more than they had as a budget for the film, and that was a big reason for the changes. Director Franklin Schaffner changed a few things when he came on, including making the ape society much simpler than what Serling wrote, basically at a medieval level of technology like we see in the films. I do wonder what Serling's script would have looked like, though.
I can shed some light on that. There actually was a comic adaptation made of Serling's version of Planet of the Apes based on that first draft version of the script, and it was published by Boom Studios. The idea was that Taylor would land in a world that was very much like ours, except that apes were the dominant life form. Some elements from Serling's script are the same as in the finished film, like the astronaut being lobotomized and the hunting scene early on. But then you get Taylor being treated almost as a celebrity at one point, at least until the cracks in the system start revealing themselves. And then you get the end twist with Taylor realizing where he's ended up right before he dies. It's a bit of a darker take by the end, but the finished film as it is still has a lot of Serling's voice in it. Escape from the Planet of the Apes even uses elements of that version.
Interesting. That is a lot like Escape for sure, with Taylor being treated like a celebrity at first, just like Zira and Cornelius were, but the cracks in the system began to show. I mean, that's basically the outline for the movie. That's really interesting. But let's get into the film itself for a bit. You know, Taylor is really kind of an asshole that doesn't know when to stop. He would not stop picking on Landon. Like, he had nothing better to do with his time than to bully those he would surely count on later if they are to survive. He just will not stop with the "everyone you know is dead and we're all stuck here" speeches. Landon at least tries to be an adult about it and asks Taylor to back off a couple of times. I mean, I wanted to punch Taylor on Landon's behalf, and I definitely would have said something in his defense if I was Dodge. I really don't like bullies, and I have a hard time standing by idly while bullying goes on in my presence.
I can understand that. Now, for me, the beauty of Rod Serling as a writer is that he gives you these characters that clearly have serious problems and in certain cases are clearly not good people. Then he confronts those characters with their own nonsense later on. I would say that Taylor is a good example of that technique, because you're right, he's a jerk in the early parts of the film, and I totally get your reaction there. I didn't like Taylor's behavior in the Landon scenes either. But eventually Taylor does get his comeuppance later when he's taken by the apes and he ends up being bullied by them. By the end of the film, he seems like he's learned his lesson a lot more, and he starts treating other people with more humanity. Taylor gets a pretty clearly defined arc in the film, and I think his character shows some growth, even if he starts off in a bad place.
That is definitely true. Taylor has definitely changed by the end of the film. He's a bit kinder, a bit gentler, or at least less aggressive. I think this came from both seeing what it was like to be caged and abused, but also I think at the end he chose reason over war, like we talked about earlier. While animosity from Taylor towards the apes is understandable, considering how he, Dodge, and Landon had been treated, I think it says something about how Taylor looked at the apes with his famous line, "Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape." He clearly feels defiled, even being touched by these lesser beings. That sounds like more than just feelings of anger about abuse and mistreatment. There is hate there that is simply a hate of what they are, not just what they have done. I point this out because I feel like it mirrors how Dr. Zaius feels about humans. Dr. Zaius really hates humans. I mean, he flat out knows the truth and pretends that he does not. He sees Taylor's writing on the ground and he wipes it away rather than accept it. When he finds the paper airplane, despite Zira being a doctor and claiming to have seen the paper airplane float in the air, Dr. Zaius says that she's speaking nonsense and crumples up the paper. I don't know about you, but that seemed a bit disrespectful and dismissive of Zira's integrity. I mean, She flat out saw it happen, and he calls her a liar. And I think that has more to do with Dr. Zaius' hatred of mankind than it did a disbelief in the validity of Dr. Zaius' claim. But you will note that when she does tell one of the other counsel what the prosecutor said, she is told to mind her tongue. So it might have something to do with just her being a woman, too. But back to Dr. Zaius, he calls Taylor and his kind a walking pestilence. Consider the adjectives that Taylor used, stinking and dirty. That sounds a lot like the sentiments of Dr. Zaius. Again, in the cave at the end, when Dr. Zaius is presented with a human doll from a time that predates the scrolls and is more advanced. And what's more, the doll talks, proving that humans at one time could talk, but he tossed it to the ground. He already knew these things he was being told, and even warns Taylor that he may not like what he finds. He is deliberately hiding the truth from his own people and blindly ignoring any evidence that might suggest something that contradicts his faith.
Agreed. I think a lot of Zaius's hatred of humans comes from the zealotry that's been instilled in him by Ape Society. This is someone who's been taught all his life that humans are evil because of what's in the scriptures passed down by the lawgiver and then his followers. Zaius also talks about the Forbidden Zone and how the humans made a desert of a land that used to be fertile, obviously foreshadowing the end twist and the fact that human civilization destroyed itself in nuclear fire. I think that knowledge turns Zaius against humanity, and he fears that if humans are left unchecked, they'll destroy ape civilization the same way. I think Zaius is definitely bigoted, but it's rooted in fear and in ignorance. I mean, he's so unwilling to see humans in any kind of positive light because of his blind zealotry, cynicism, and fear for his own people.
That certainly makes a lot of sense, even if I think he chose the wrong path. I can at least see how he got there. I thought this bit was interesting. The apes clearly have racial inclinations in their society beyond humans. Check this out. I noticed that the orangutans all held positions of power and authority. They were the government officials and even the priests. Gorillas are all guards or soldiers, and the chimpanzees seem to handle the scientific and intellectual side of things. We see in Beneath the Planet of the Apes that they even sit in segregated sections when they meet and wear designated clothes for their race. Just imagine a society where what you did in life was determined by your race rather than your own passions and desires. Like, what if a chimp wanted to be a politician, or what if a gorilla wanted to be a scientist, and so on? It seems that race is central to their society, and everyone has their place. There seems to be no place for individuality. When Taylor was brought before the tribunal, Zira tried to point out that Taylor was unlike any man they had ever come across. But the fact that he was a man is all they needed to hear. Even when Taylor tried to speak to defend himself, which no other human could do, they immediately silenced him. They were not even interested in what he had to say. Let me put that into a perspective for you. Imagine if we found an ape who could speak English and the court refused to acknowledge that the ape was any different than any other apes. And when the ape spoke to defend himself, the court strangled him into silence. I don't know about you, but I imagine that if there were such a case where say an orangutan wanted to be a soldier, he would be put in his place in a similar fashion. Granted, we don't see much complaint from anyone in this, but I find this interesting.
Yeah, what you're describing is a race-based caste system, which is where you're born into determines what you are. The apes seem to have a belief that biology determines your place in life, and what you are is more important than who you are. As for the tribunal, I think it was meant to be this weird twist on the Scopes monkey trial from 1925, where a teacher was put on trial for teaching evolution in school, which at that time was illegal. Thankfully, that it was overturned. Though in practice, it plays out more as a show trial in the movie, which is more about determining a finding of guilt than about determining the truth. So we see that the apes' understanding of law is about in line with their understanding of science. They're not finding truth by following evidence or procedure. They're reaching the outcome they want and using the rules to justify the verdict they want to hand out anyway. I'll also mention as an aside that the moment where the three apes do the see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil motions is just perfect. It sums up what a farce the whole system is.
That describes that trial very well. It does reflect a human impulse as well that I assume scientists in general must struggle with to some degree, and that is coming up with a theory and looking through the evidence to support the theory rather than follow the evidence where it may lead. But let's move on to the sequel to The Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which hit theaters just 2 years later in 1970. Beneath the Planet of the Apes was directed by Ted Post, written by Paul Den, and produced by Arthur P. Jacobs. The film stars James Franciscus as Brent, the astronaut sent to find Taylor and the crew of the Icarus, Kim Hunter reprising her role as Dr. Zira, Maurice Evans again plays Dr. Zaius, and Linda Harrison as Nova. And unlike the first film, where he was the star, we see Charlton Heston playing a supporting role as Taylor.
The way they did the sequel without its main star was so bizarre to me. Apparently, Charlton Heston didn't want to do a sequel, and he bowed out of reprising Taylor. However, after some negotiation, Heston agreed to appear in Beneath the Planet of the Apes as long as his appearance was brief and that they killed off Taylor by the end of the film. So you got this new astronaut named Brent who takes over the Taylor role, while Taylor only makes these brief and sporadic appearances. Brent isn't a hugely memorable substitute, it must be said. Heston's charisma and screen presence are very hard to replace. On the other hand, sidelining Heston did allow for Zira and Cornelius to be a bigger part of the franchise from here on out. And I'll admit that it is cool when Taylor teams up with Brent towards the end.
I thought that was weird too, but hearing that behind the scenes info there certainly makes it make sense. Honestly, I prefer Zira and Cornelius to Taylor or any other human in the series for that matter. So I think it turned out for the best. And you're right that it was there was a cool team up at the end there. But if I'm honest, Beneath the Planet of the Apes is my second to least favorite in the franchise, just before Battle for the Planet of the Apes. So the cultists who worship the atomic bomb and claim to be pacifists because they don't physically attack their enemies. Even their weapons of peace are in fact harmful. Plus they clearly have a psychic attack that they use on Brent, when they are interrogating him. They also take control of people's minds and force them to commit acts of violence. I mean, that scene where they forced Taylor and Brent to fight was downright cruel. For a pacifist, that guy was sure getting off on the pain he was inflicting and the violence he was watching. Just because psionic weapons are not physical does not make them less violent. And an attack is an attack regardless of physicality. For instance, radiation, biological weapons, and whatever that pain-inflicting thing they do is. But I think this touches on one of the themes of the series I will talk about later, but this particular theme deals with religious fanaticism and just how insane it can look when put on display. I mean, if you can wrap your head around the reasoning of the cultists, I'd like to hear it, but the whole thing just seems out there like Pluto to me.
No, they're pretty much insane, and I think that's the point. These are people who are mutated and forced to live underground, and they turn to this weird form of religion to survive. The one element about them I do find interesting is that the idea that they don't inflict violence themselves, but they use their telepathic powers to turn their enemies against each other. It absolutely is still violence. I mean, they've just convinced themselves into this delusion that it isn't, simply because they're not using their hands to do it. The other bizarre thing is the idea that they worship a weapon of war because they think it brings peace. This is probably meant to be a commentary on the idea of mutually assured destruction, which is the idea that the threat of nuclear annihilation holds the nuclear powers in check. Everything about this cult's belief system is contradictory, nonsensical, and flat out crazy. By the time you get to the cathedral scene and the over-the-top bonkers him to the bomb, you know you're dealing with people who are completely out of their minds.
You know, hearing you describe that reminds me of an Ozzy Osbourne song called Thank God for the Bomb, where he talks about the ridiculousness and craziness of the nuclear arms race and war in general. But at the same time, he says that if that threat is the only thing stopping war, implying that there should be a lot more than that stopping us from going to war, then thank God for the bomb. Granted, Ozzy makes a bit more sense in his song, but it sounds like they built some kind of twisted religion out of that idea.
That's what I think happens, yeah. I suspect that Paul Dean, the writer, probably wrote that whole religious hymn about the holy fallout I mean, he was known for writing really weird takes on older songs, so it's the kind of thing I could see him having written.
So, Beneath the Planet of the Apes certainly ends suddenly. I mean, Taylor pushes down that crystal and ignites the cobalt-plated atomic bomb, which is apparently powerful enough to destroy the Earth, puts an end to the whole planet. But here's my question. Why did Taylor blow up the whole planet? Was it a selfish act intended to destroy his enemies, the apes? Basically, I'm dying anyway, so who cares if the whole planet goes? Or was it perhaps a belief that the upside-down world he had come home to should not even go on?
I'll give you the behind-the-scene answer first, then my take on the ending, and then from there I'll address the question properly. According to the extras on the Blu-ray, 20th Century Fox was really close to bankruptcy, and the banks were really coming after them. There were also off-screen power struggles between the president of the studio, Richard Zanuck, and the shareholders, which included Zanuck's own father. Zanuck invested a lot in making sure the movie was made, Richard, and he was instrumental in getting Charlton Heston come back. Unfortunately, Zanuck actually got fired in the middle of production. On the way out, he decided to end the movie by blowing the whole planet up. So that's the reason why you get this weird rocks fall, everyone dies ending. When I first saw it, my reaction to that moment was WTF. I mean, it comes out of nowhere, and it doesn't click at all with Taylor's journey from the first film. I mean, this is a man who is cynical about his own people because he thinks they're destined to destroy themselves, and then he's proven right with the Statue of Liberty scene. He rides off in the sunset with Nova in the hope of building something better than what humanity had built, or the inhumanity of the apes. In Pierre Boulle's version of the script, that's basically what he tries to do even. So why would a man like that decide to set off the doomsday device after all that, especially since his mission with Brent was to prevent nuclear annihilation? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense at all. But looking for an in-story reason behind it, one possibility that comes to mind is that Taylor's mind was damaged by the telepathic torture he received at the hands of the cult. He was imprisoned there a long time, and they probably caused quite a bit of psychic damage to his mind during his capture. He probably was dealing with quite a bit of trauma by the end of the film. It could just be that he just snapped in that last moment and decided to end everything. It's not a good explanation, though, I will admit.
I think I like that idea better than the two I came up with. At least that explanation does not contradict his previous character arc. It's a lot easier for me to blame PTSD or even brain damage for what he did, because at least he doesn't backpedal as much at the end.
You're right. I still don't like it, but I can buy that more than I can buy that Taylor knowingly turned his back on everything he learned in the first movie. While there's a fair amount I like about this film, the way they ended things casts a huge pall in the series. And it makes a mess of the sequels, too. So why don't we talk about the next film?
I'd be glad to. The third film in the franchise, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, came out the very next year in 1971. And the successive sequels would follow suit, and each one would come out 1 year after the last film. A new director came on for this film named Don Taylor, but writer Paul Den stayed on from Beneath the Planet of the Apes. It stars Roddy McDowall as Dr. Cornelius, Kim Hunter as Dr. Zira, Bradford Dillman as Dr. Lewis Dixon, and Ricardo Montalban came back to play Armando.
This is a movie I have some mixed feelings about. Where I think this film really works is when it centers on Zira and Cornelius. Those two are great, and the relationship between those characters is heartwarming and fun. McDowell and Hunter are great performers, even under all that ape makeup. However, there's quite a bit in this film that gets bent around to justify this movie existing at all. There is a huge reach of logic just in trying to get Zira and Cornelius back to 1973 and away from the destruction of the Earth in the future. But before I get into that, I think you had a point you wanted to make about the last film and how it connects it to Escape.
Oh, I actually do. I just have to comment on the whole cobalt bomb thing from Beneath the Planet of the Apes, as it has an effect on the story and Escape from the Planet of the Apes as well. A cobalt bomb is a type of salted bomb, a nuclear weapon designed to produce enhanced amounts of radioactive fallout intended to contaminate a large area with radioactive material, potentially for the purpose of radiological warfare, mutually assured destruction, or as a doomsday device. But in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, we find out that the blast apparently affected time itself, as Dr. Milo, the ape who came out who came back in time with Dr. Zero and Cornelius explains. The blast from the Earth exploding after Taylor ignites the cobalt bomb actually sent them backwards in time. While the first film was accurate about his time travel, science based on near light speed velocity and time dilation, this film seems to take some serious liberties with it.
I'm with you on that. I also have a lot of problems with the setup of this movie. You're right that using the destruction of Earth should not send the ship backwards in time the way it does here. It's not believable in any way that this just happens to send Zira, Cornelius, and Milo back to the exact time that Taylor left. They'd have been better served by just explaining that there's some kind of stable wormhole in space-time, and they followed Taylor's same trajectory back to where he came from. This is a case where they're over-explaining things, and it becomes harder to hand-wave and accept. But there's also a huge leap in logic just for Zero and Cornelius to have made it back to the past. So we have to accept that they just happened to decide to leave Earth right after the gorillas start marching. They have no reason to believe that the world's going to be destroyed at that point. So why are they abandoning their people like this, especially after the other chimpanzees were jailed by the gorillas? Even if we allow that they just decide to give up on ape society and leave with Milo, there's a lot of things they'd have to overcome just to get off the planet. Taylor's spaceship was submerged in the middle of a lake by that point. How could three chimpanzees move the ship out of the water, presumably with no help and trying to keep out of sight of the gorillas? Even Taylor's crew had no way to do that. And even if Milo is the Reed Richards of the chimpanzees, the ship probably suffered a lot of damage from waterlogging and disuse. How long would it have taken to make it even close to spaceworthy? Even with only a 3-8 crew? I mean, probably a lot more time than they had to get off the planet before Taylor pressed the button. They'd have needed time to run tests as well, and that would have taken them a while. Also, and here's something that was never addressed. Where did Zero and Cornelius think they were going? They weren't planning to end up in Earth's past. They got there by accident. So they get off the planet and then go where? What would be in range that would be even remotely livable to apes? Also, keep in mind that to go to any planet that's even remotely habitable, they'd have needed to go into cryosleep for probably centuries. I mean, I get that they need a hand wave a lot of things away here, because otherwise there's no movie. I also get that the ending of Beneath left the writers with not many places to go, and I totally sympathize with that. But you pretty much have to accept a series of miracles in order to accept that this movie even happens. There are way too many things that happen that don't make any sense that you have to ignore.
There really are a whole lot of holes in the plot, and you really do have to pretend you don't notice to enjoy the film. But I think, as you said, Zanuck really kind of blew up the building on his way out of the studio, and didn't the studio just didn't have much choice in the matter as far as having to find a way to work around all of that. But honestly, I wonder if time was not a factor. You know, each sequel from 2 onward came out the following year. Some real thought needed to be put into how to get around the end of part 2. And I think they had to go with whatever they could come up with on the fly to get it done.
That wouldn't surprise me. I have sympathy for the writers in being in a really tough position. And I like Zero and Cornelius not being dead. So I'm willing to let the ridiculous setup go for the movie to happen.
Me too. That's a tough job on a very popular franchise. That could not have been easy under that kind of pressure. I really like Zira and Cornelia, so I was pleasantly surprised that they were not dead as well. But speaking of them going back in time, I find it interesting that Cornelius had to lie about not knowing Taylor, because revealing that apes in their future do the same things to humans as humans do to animals, dissect, analyze, experiment on them. Dr. Zira has to correct herself from saying that she dissected humans a couple of times. Honestly, it is reflective of the animal cruelty theme that comes up again and again in the franchise, and I'll elaborate more on that later. But in this particular instance, humans are faced with the harsh realities of using animals in this fashion when the shoe is actually on the other foot.
Very true. I'll add that I feel bad for Zira, because she clearly has regrets about the work she had to do as an ape scientist. And understandably so. I think she honestly meant well, but was ignorant of what humans truly were at that time. And then she turned out to be wrong about them. She also is trying to keep certain things under wraps. And that's just not the kind of person Zira is. She's a believer in the truth as a scientist, and she's honest to the point of bluntness. And now she's being confronted with the reality of the work that she did and having to answer for it, both to herself and to the committee.
You know, I hadn't picked up on that before, but you're right about Zira. Just not being the secretive type and a seeker of truth. I'm guessing that's why she needed all the grape juice plus. Having to act out of character was probably nerve-wracking for her.
Oh, I'm sure. And on top of that, she's dealing with being an expectant mother and figuring out how to raise a child in a completely new world. I mean, she had a lot of pressure on her.
Good call on that one, my friend. I love seeing Cornelius get fitted for a suit and the tailor asks him if he can measure his inside leg. There's a pause for a few seconds where I can only imagine Cornelius is trying to figure out why he would want to do that. He just says, no, like, of course not. Another part that stuck out to me was Cornelius' reaction to watching a boxing match. As a pacifist, he must have been mortified to see humans put violence on display for entertainment like that. He certainly looked disturbed and not entertained. But I would also like to point out that Zira and Cornelius are not truly pacifists. If they were, they would not have killed the guy that was delivering their food. However, while they don't show it on camera, you clearly see that the guy has a big hole in his head with blood on the ground. So he also would not have shot and killed Dr. Otto Hoslin on the ship. I mean, it was a dire circumstance, but I think it would be more accurate to say that violence is the last resort as opposed to not an option. But either way, when Cornelius said it was beastly, the man just laughed. When the boxing match was just beastly. I'll be honest that it made me think about enjoying violence as a sport. I mean, not enough to quit watching it, but I will admit that it's barbaric.
It does make you think. I can definitely see why Cornelius would see it that way. And I love the boxing scene, too. As to the point on his pacifism, I think Cornelius is forced to make difficult choices as a husband and a father. He tries to be a pacifist. In general, I don't think he seeks out violence, and I think he hates resorting to it. But it just hits different when you're an expectant father and someone's actively trying to take and kill your child. At that point, the protective instincts kick in. I don't care who you are. What I came away with is that Cornelius loves his wife and his child more than he hates violence. He'll resort to it if it means keeping Zira and baby Milo safe, whatever the personal cost to himself. It's a breach of his principles as a pacifist, but I think one that's understandable given how bad their situation is by that point.
I can certainly see and understand that. When it comes to the life of your child and wife, a man really has no choice at this point, so I can respect that. Honestly, it only bothers me because of all of his speeches about ape superiority because they don't kill each other.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And those things get ramped up hard in the next film. So let's talk about what happens to baby Milo when he grows up.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. I think we should do that. The fourth film in the franchise, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, came out in 1972. And once again, a new director was brought on to do it named J. Lee Thompson. However, the film had the same writer from the last two films, Paul Dent. So that was a plus. And once again, Arthur P. Jacobs produced the film. The film stars Roddy McDowall as Caesar, Don Murray as the evil Governor Breck, and Ricardo Montalban once again plays Armando. But this would be the last appearance of Armando killing, since Armando kills himself in the film rather than give up Caesar.
Montalban is one of the greats, and he's excellent in the short time he gets in the series. I mean, Armando is this fun, roguish character who brings real heart as Caesar's foster father. I thought the way that he died was a bit off. I mean, if you have a reliable device that can make a suspect tell the truth on demand, why drag out the whole procedure before only using it at the very end? It's never used again after this either. But Armando gets his cool heroic sacrifice. It's awesome. And you can tell that he truly loves Caesar like a son.
I think Armando killing himself was more of a plot device. Caesar believed up until he heard that Armando killed himself rather than give him up, that he had been abandoned and betrayed by Armando. If he hadn't killed himself, that realization could not have happened.
Yeah, Armando's death needed to happen because it's a huge catalyst for Caesar's vengeance. I mean, the execution was just a bit clunky there. Anyway, I thought it was a great move to cast Roddy McDowall as Caesar. I think that it gives the series some continuity with his presence. And McDowall's a good enough actor to make Caesar a different character from Cornelius while keeping the family resemblance. Also, aside from McDowall, Paul Dean and Arthur P. Jacobs are the two most consistent things throughout the sequels, which is probably why these movies are as solid as they are.
Yeah, Roddy McDowall playing both Cornelius and Caesar really worked well. And having Paul Dean, sorry, I've been saying that wrong the whole episode, and Arthur P. Jacobs behind the scenes really make the sequels work. We are in 100% agreement there.
Yeah, Dean is a writer I've grown to really like as I've watched these movies. I mean, he doesn't hit every note perfectly, but he does great stuff when he's on his game. Anyway, I digress, so let's get into what happens with Milo.
In Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Zero and Cornelius named their child Milo after the scientist that came with him. But either they did not give that name to Armando, or the owner of the circus, or he decided to change his name. They don't actually explain the name change in the film. Either way, Milo's name is Caesar from the very start of Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
It takes some doing of some of the work of the film, but I think it makes sense. I assume that Caesar was the name of the baby chimp that Milo replaced. Milo basically assumed his identity with the baby swap, and he took the Caesar name to stay hidden. It might be that Armando decided that using the name Milo was too risky, so he went with Caesar instead. The world needed to believe that baby Milo was dead, so Armando played into that to keep him safe. I don't have a problem with it.
I don't have a problem with it either, and what you said there totally makes sense. I guess I would have just liked to have gotten a definitive answer, though. I love how in 1972's version of Future 1991, they still have the same kinds of phones, but the futuristic part is that they don't have any phone cords. Anybody who was alive when corded phones were around can tell you that they were a pain. So I don't know about you. I just found that funny.
This is definitely the 90s as seen from the 70s. I don't think that cell phones were around in 91, but they weren't too off or off from then. Still, you're right that corded phones could be really annoying to use.
Oh, and how bleak did the people in the 70s see the future? I mean, shit. Conquest of the Planet of the Apes takes place in the far-flung future of 1991. It seems ridiculous to us now that things would have gotten to that point when we see things in Conquest. We kind of chuckle, actually, about it when we watch it. But honestly, I wonder if people will watch Beneath the Planet of the Apes in 3955 and laugh, too. But seriously, right off the bat in Conquest, you get a taste of how things are when it comes to apes. When Armando and Caesar get off the helicopter, and the guard's first question was if Armando was authorized to dress Caesar like he was dressed. And Armando said, of course, and gave him the paperwork to prove it. That was very subtle, but it speaks volumes of how the world's perception of apes has changed in the last 20 years since Zero and Cornelius were there. I mean, just imagine the oppressive hatred involved in having to have paperwork to dress apes. What were at the time pets to humans? I mean, there weren't any dogs or cats in this movie. In this movie's 1991, they all died off in a plague brought back from the astronauts. But even if they were, I doubt there would be such regulations put on putting a sweater on or an outfit on one of them. In fact, that is basically considered to be cute by most people. It's like society and the very authoritarian government in place in that 1991 are trying to do everything they can to keep apes in their place and appear as unevolved as possible in fear of the future that Zero and Cornelius represented. But even citizens there were threatened by things like being punished with denial to trade for 5 years. Imagine that. You can't conduct any commerce for 5 years. How would you survive? The police were also able to arrest Armando and hold him indefinitely because he might have had an ape that could talk. There were no Miranda rights or a lawyer present. It's like all of those laws that were in place before don't even matter now. The new authoritarian government has a whole new way of doing things. Or did you notice the nightstick happy police going around bashing all the apes and keeping the humans in line? So even though humans lived more freely than the apes, it would seem that there were strict rules and regulations for them as well.
Yeah, I don't think the bleakness of this movie is a 70s thing. I think it's a Paul Dean thing. Dean was a British writer. He was actually the writer on Goldfinger before this, and he brought a very British perspective to the series. A number of British SF writers around that time were fascinated with bleak totalitarian futures. That probably started with George Orwell, and he influenced some of the later British writers of the day. Dean was also someone who was fascinated by the idea of nuclear war. So this is a writer probably didn't have a whole lot of faith in humanity's future. This becomes an issue in the fifth film as well, but I'll bring that up when we get there. I have the same issues you do when it comes to the idea of the country suddenly turning into a police state within 20 years. It certainly didn't turn out that way in our own history, and it feels way too sudden without some kind of believable catalyst for it. There are details that turn out the way that Cornelius predicted it, like the plague that kills the animals. It's explained in Battle that, you know, as you said, this is because Cornelius and Zira brought back the Plague of the Future. So that makes sense. But here it feels a bit weird. I also don't really buy the idea of apes going from pets to household slaves. You could probably build robots to do these kind of things. I don't know. I just get the feeling that there's a lot of needless brutality in these films. And these things are hand-waved to make that happen.
Oh, I'm guessing if they were robots, there would have been phone cords attached. No, seriously. It does seem like the things just went out of control really quickly. Governor Breck, I think, clearly lays out the path humanity took after Zerus and Cornelia and why they hate apes so much in 1991 when he says, "Because your kind were once our ancestors, man was born of the ape, and there is still an ape curled up inside every man. The beast that must be whipped into submission. The savage that has to be shackled and chained. You are that beast, Caesar. You taint us. You poison our guts. When we hate you, we're hating the dark side of ourselves." But ultimately, for all of Caesar's and the ape's righteous anger, Caesar pretty much spells out that his intention is to do to humans what they have done to apes, which to me suggests that the issue has less to do with right or wrong, but wanting to be the one that's doing it. I'm reminded of Dr. Zaius' words to Taylor when Taylor called their world upside down. Dr. Zaius says that you may very well call it upside down when you find yourself at the bottom of it. McDonald actually tries to point out that this is not the way to affect positive change, but Caesar is blinded by his own rage at that point. It took Lisa, a female chimp that Caesar had become attached to being the first of the other apes to speak to get his attention. And she did it with just one word and tears in her eyes as the gorillas were about to beat Governor Breck to death with the butts of their rifles at Caesar's order. She turns to him and just says, "No." Then Caesar seems to come to his senses to some degree, although there is still some hypocrisy there. And he clearly missed why Lisa was even crying and says that for now we will put away our hatred and put down our weapons because we have been through the night of fires and those that were once our masters are now our servants. He goes on to say that while it is their destiny to dominate man, they will do so with compassion, unlike the humans. They will be humane where humans were not. However, that is in the theatrical cut. My understanding is that originally, Caesar orders the gorillas to kill Breck and the others. And I've seen the footage. It is graphic and very violent. The rage of 100 gorillas and the fury of an entire race come crashing down on just a few men. And we're talking about crushed skulls and everything. Just imagine what it would be like for several men to be beaten to death with rifles. It was a bit much for early audiences to take, so they changed it for the theatrical release of the film.
I saw the unrated film, but I can see why the theatrical cut was toned down a bit. I mean, it gets intense towards the end for sure. And this movie was so bleak that the filmmakers were concerned about the kids watching it. Honestly, I see Caesar's arc in these movies as being not unlike Magneto's in the X-Men comics. He's someone who starts off being victimized by the humans because he's different. His parents were murdered by humans, and it's only the influence of Armando that gives him compassion towards humans at all. Then he sees the suffering of his people and he decides to do something about it, you know, vowing never again. He becomes a terrorist or freedom fighter, depending on how you see it, devoted to the violent path before seeing a better way of going about things. Caesar is very often torn between the path of his father and using violence as a way of gaining freedom for his people. He's a very interesting character, and I think it shows in this film. By the end, he absolutely has established himself as the main hero of the last two films.
That's a nice comparison, and I think it puts his character in a slightly different light now that I think about it. The slavery metaphors are pretty thick in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. As we discussed earlier, that is an ongoing theme in the series, but Conquest seems to lean on it the heaviest. I have seen a lot of footage from the Civil Rights era, and in that footage, I have watched many cops beating and dragging away Black people, blasting them with fire hoses and more in that footage. And I have to say that the montage of abuse and inequality we see in the reconditioning area by those guys who are dressed a lot like cops beating the apes with nightsticks mimics actions of the cops from those videos I saw. Honestly, if I had to guess, I would even say that actors likely watched that footage for themselves or the people who trained the actors did. I mean, I don't know, but that is definitely my takeaway from that scene. When I was a kid, I hadn't seen all of that and didn't have that knowledge that I have now. But I can tell you this time through, that was difficult to watch. I suppose the most obvious screaming at you scene about slavery has got to be the auction, where apes are paraded around and sold just like slaves once were here in America. It carried even more weight when you consider that the government officials were there at the auction. Plus, is it just me or do the soldiers' uniforms look a lot like Nazi uniforms?
No, it's not just you. I think they were definitely aiming for a Nazi allegory with the future cops. It's also true that the civil rights metaphors run pretty thick in this movie. While I think using apes as a metaphor for the black struggle is problematic by today's standards, I think that's probably the allegory that Paul Dean was going for. The violence of the civil rights era was still very recent by the time the movie was made, and that was a major influence on the film. Vietnam was still an issue around that time, too, and the protests going on over that. I mean, Dean references that in Beneath as well, with the chimps protesting the gorillas. In Conquest, though, you get overt reference to police brutality mixed in with the Orwellian police state metaphor and subtle nods to Nazi Germany. I mean, Dean was a writer who was not shy about inserting social commentary into his films, and I think it's all over this movie.
It is very problematic by today's standards, for sure. You'll note those things were removed in the new Planet of the Apes films. But there is still social commentary in the new films, but Dean really takes things to a dark place. I have to agree with your assessment that he did not have a good outlook for humanity's future.
No, not at all. I think that pessimism seeps through each of the sequels, with Battle being the only exception. Even Caesar tends to express that viewpoint from time to time.
You know, the humans obviously picked up on there being something special about Caesar. They talked about how he showed signs of intelligence and familiarity with humans to an extent that conditioning was not necessary. But they had to hear about him from others or interact with Caesar himself to pick up on it. I noticed that the other apes of various types all seemed to recognize that there was something different about Caesar just passing by and or looking at him. I'm just speculating, but Armando talked about how Caesar likely picked up a lot of mannerisms and whatnot from Armando over their 20 years together. Plus, I think Caesar, using the quote, "the king is dead, long live the king," when they took the city and captured Governor Breck, speaks to an education beyond the reading and writing we saw him do. I say this because the phrase was coined in 1422 at the death of Charles VI, when Charles VII immediately took the throne, and is now traditionally said when the same type of things happens. While Governor Breck was not yet dead, that statement, in a very intellectual kind of way, was a very big threat. That speaks of history and knowledge of culture. All of that to say that Caesar was educated and intelligent. So to the apes, I imagine it was like feeling the presence of a human in the body of an ape.
I'm pretty sure that Armando gave Caesar a pretty thorough education when he raised him at the circus. Armando probably understood that giving Caesar a good grounding in classical education would eventually make a difference for him later in life. And he turns out to be right about that. It's also definitely true that Caesar is more human than most of his kind, in both good and bad ways. He has very human sensibilities, but also the human capacity for violence. It's the very thing that Breck points out in his end speech. I found that the humans figured things out with Caesar way too quickly, though, from the situation with Armando. I mean, the governor has no real reason to suspect that Baby Milo survived or that Caesar is intelligent. I mean, they come to that conclusion way too quickly on too flimsy evidence. The weird thing is that there is one moment that they overlook that should have made him suspicious about Caesar. When Caesar flips through the book and quickly points to his name in the book, that should have tipped somebody off, but nobody makes a thing of it. It's like they rush through their conclusions because that's what the plot requires them to do.
The only thing that I can think of is that they were hyper aware that a talking ape would someday come, from what Zira and Cornelius told them, and that caused them to jump to conclusions there.
Maybe, but I'm kind of skeptical about that. I mean, Brett comes across as overly paranoid, if that's the case. But then I guess he wouldn't be the first politician to be driven by paranoia and the irrational fear of losing his power, which of course becomes literally a self-fulfilling prophecy in the case of Caesar.
You know, I have heard it said about fate that all of one's attempts at avoiding it will only end up being the very cause of it happening. And that is, as you say, exactly what happened to Caesar. So when Armando didn't come back for Caesar, he tried to tough it out, but things were not good. In fact, it was looking like while he was raised with freedom in the circus, his kind were enslaved and brutalized back in the world. I imagine he felt like his last hope might be his friend Armando, who raised him. I think in that scene where Caesar sees the poster of Armando's old-time circus, he realizes that Armando is never coming back. The last truly kind and respectful human in Caesar's life is gone, leaving only the horrible people that now seem to occupy the world. I believe that was the moment Caesar gave up hope in a peaceful life he once had, or any chance of going back to the circus away from all of his madness. Governor Breck suggests that at that moment he realized that Armando was dead and that he had likely betrayed him to those who had captured him. If that is true, I think that better explains Caesar's strong reaction. But either way, all Caesar had left at that point was his people. He later tells McDonald that while he is not a myth, that humans can be kind is a myth, save for a small handful of humans, like I would hope included McDonald. And you'll note that there's just a small handful of trusted humans in battle for the Planet of the Apes. Caesar asserts to McDonald's that humans won't learn to be kind until apes force them to, but that they cannot force them to until they are free and have power themselves. And to be free, they need to revolt. In fact, there needs to be an all-around revolution. So I think that comment is definitely reflective of that moment as well. I say that because after crying his eyes out and screaming uncontrollably, he runs off, and the next thing you know, the apes, who have been rebelling all over anyway, are organizing, gathering weapons. Caesar is making an army.
Mm-hmm. Armando's death will really leave Caesar with his last lingering faith in his humanity gone. Armando, up to that point, was the only human who had shown Caesar any real kindness and compassion. I also think that Caesar learned with Armando's death how humans had no regard for their own kind. I think that lesson is why Caesar later comes up with the sacred law of ape shall not kill ape, because to him, human-on-human violence is unthinkable until that moment. And when he learns of Armando's death, Caesar is looking for revenge as well as justice for his kind. But I think the influence of McDonald later shows Caesar that there is some hope for humans, and that leads to Caesar trying to build a society where apes and humans can live together in peace. Caesar grows to see past vengeance, and over time he starts to embrace his parents' ideals, even if he doesn't realize it yet. That leads Caesar to where he ends up in the final film, so why don't we get into that?
Sure thing, Steve. The fifth and final film in the original franchise was 1973's Battle for the Planet of the Apes, directed by J. Lee Thompson, who is the first director in the original franchise to direct more than one film. Arthur P. Jacobs, of course, produced, as he had on the other films, and while the story was by Paul Dean, he did not write the screenplay on this one. That was done by John and his wife, Joyce Corrington. Roddy McDowall returns to play Caesar. Claude Atkins plays General Aldo. Natalie Trundy comes back to play Lisa, Caesar's wife. Severn Darden plays Governor Culp. Paul Williams plays Virgil, Caesar's trusted advisor, and John Huston is the lawgiver.
So according to the extras in the Blu-ray, there were reasons for why Paul Dean wasn't involved with the screenplay. Partly was because the producers felt the series was too bleak for the kids, and they wanted the fifth film to be more hopeful, but mostly it was because Dean had come down with a serious illness, and he was just physically unable to write the screenplay. So they brought in the Carringtons to do the screenplay based on Dean's original story. I think Dean's voice is still present in the film, and there is some consistency, but this is a lighter film, even if it has some darker moments here and there.
In my opinion, the Carringtons did not put the thought into the script that Dean did in his. A lot of the film seems rushed and a little forced to me, and I think it would have felt more natural if Dean had done it, even if his view of the future is very bleak. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I do prefer to end the series on a hopeful note, but on the other hand, I think if Dean had been able to write it, you'd have gotten more of his voice in the film. That is a regrettable loss for this movie, though there is still some of Dean in it.
For sure. There are definitely moments in there that felt like it, particularly in the ape interactions at the beginning. But if we could switch over to talking about the story itself, it would seem that perhaps MacDonald was not able to get through to Caesar as he had hoped. While society itself is simpler, the injustice, racism, and inequality that Caesar prophesied at the end of Conquest of the Planet of the Apes is in full effect in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. And MacDonald's younger brother, also just called MacDonald, is the one to point that out to Caesar, just like his brother was. But Caesar seemed very content with his vengeful and loosely controlled society, at least until Aldo starts taking over and inciting the guerrillas. One of the reasons he saw nothing wrong with the humans not living with them as equals was because the only examples of how things like this had turned out before were all from human history, and apes' history would be different because apes never kill apes. But you'll note that Caesar does kill Aldo, because Aldo kills his son, Cornelius, and Virgil points out to Caesar that apes do not kill apes. I've been mentioning that all along, actually. In Caesar's case, letting go of Aldo's arm calls back to his comment about destroying evil for the greater good. But I have to admit that I like that in the reboot franchise, Caesar sees apes and humans are not so different. Honestly, this is the best arc of the movie. The hypocrisy of doing unto them what they have done unto you was finally brought to the forefront and dealt with. And in my opinion, that is Battle's one real redeeming grace. It is my least favorite in the series.
Caesar is in a better place by this film, but I agree that he doesn't really fulfill his promise until the end. I think that it was good that Caesar gave freedom to the humans at the end of the movie after realizing how much his vengeance has cost him. I agree that Battle is probably the least of the original five films, but there are things I dig about it. I like the idea of an armorer who is also the king's conscience and who only gives out weapons for moral reasons. That was really interesting. I like the revelation for why the mutant society we see in Beneath turns out as it does. It starts with some reasonable ideas, but like many cults, it gets corrupted by its own dogma and the inflexible beliefs in his followers. I also thought that John Huston was really good as the lawgiver, and I like that the 27th century shows some hope for peace between the two sides, but I have my share of problems with this movie, too. I think you had one that you wanted to bring up, Mike?
I do, but I want to comment on something you said real quick. I actually liked the ape society stuff that they did in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Those things you mentioned were very nice. I also liked that Caesar put an importance on education. However, the humans, at least the radiated ones, are just nuts. The leader of the humans, Governor Culp, is just ridiculous. He is just itching to start a war with the apes out of boredom. And even when the apes are trying to escape and almost do, he encourages his troops to kill them over and over again and warns that they are getting away. I mean, what would have been so terrible about them getting away? I mean, this is one bloodthirsty dude. He's also paranoid and delusional. Why the apes didn't launch a single missile, he suddenly blames them for the nuclear weapons that destroyed the Earth and is convinced, again without evidence, that the apes will come back to the humans' desolate city to exterminate the few humans who survived the apes' previous attempt to exterminate man. Even his own men are like, why? What is the matter with you?
I'm with you on Governor Culp, and I'm glad you were as annoyed with him as I was. The villains start getting cartoonishly evil in the later films, but I really hated Culp. Brick in the last film was a card-carrying fascist dictator, but at least his end speech had some fair points behind it. But Culp is just evil because he's evil, and he's worse. He's doing evil when it doesn't even benefit him in any way. His motivations in this film make no sense. What did the mutants gain by killing the apes or going on an all-out assault on Ape City? Absolutely nothing that justifies him getting him and his own people killed. I could understand if Caesar had taken something of value to the mutants and Culp wanted to get it back, but Caesar was just after a recording of his parents. That doesn't hurt the mutants at all. I could understand if Culp has genuine political reason to attack the apes, such as taking their resources. But it seems to me that the mutants have everything they need in the underground city, so they don't need anything from the apes. Culp seems to be driven just by this blind hatred, even to the detriment of his own people. And that's just a bad motivation. What I find really surprising is that a lot of his people are going along with this, even though they should know this fight is pointless. I mean, only one major character even questions Culp's terrible decisions. And then they even take it to the point of almost using the Alpha Omega bomb, which is the height of insanity. Honestly, Aldo did the apes and the mutants a service by killing Culp. He's a bad villain. And not only is he inexplicably evil, he's suicidally and stupidly evil. He deserves the death he gets.
We are as one on this one, my friend. Overall, I liked the original Planet of the Apes films. Granted, I used to watch them with my dad. It was something that we both enjoyed. So there's some nostalgia and fond memories there. I think my favorites of the series... in the series are the first film, obviously, but also despite the flaws in the story, I really liked Escape from the Planet of the Apes, and Conquest is probably my number three. But if I'm honest, I much prefer the new films. What about you, Steve? What are your overall thoughts on the original franchise, and which ones are your favorites?
The original one is easily my favorite, and I don't see much that's ever going to change that. I mean, it's a cinema classic. And as a Rod Serling fan, I really appreciate it. It's almost like a feature-length Twilight Zone episode. Conquest is probably my second favorite, if only because Escape is brought down by the end of Beneath and the ludicrous hand wave they had to do for the movie to work. Still, both of those are really good Dean's Jacobs films. And I will say that there's a fair amount in Beneath that I like, even though the ending almost ruined the series.
That's fair. And I can honestly admit that there is stuff about Beneath that I like as well. But that about wraps up episode one of our two-part Planet of the Apes discussion. We'll see you tomorrow with part two, where we will briefly discuss 1974's television series, the Tim Burton movie, and the three latest Planet of the Apes movies, Rise, Dawn, and War. For now, I'd like to take this moment to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've enjoyed hanging out with us on ORP today. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to please share this episode and help us get the word out.
That is indeed a big help, and we want to thank you in advance for your support of both listening and sharing this episode. It means a lot to us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.